Hello and welcome to the WIFPIX World PICU Awareness Week podcast series. I'm Dr. Robin Saggers, Pediatric Critical Care Fellow at Chris Hani Baragwanath Academic Hospital in Soweto, Johannesburg. It is a great privilege to have with me today Dr. Kuben Naidu, who is one of the senior pediatric intensivists here at Bara, which is the popular name for the largest hospital in South Africa. Kuben, welcome.
Thanks, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here, and I thank the organizers for the invitation.
Today, we will be focusing on the B elements of the ABCDEF, or ICU Liberation Bundle. Kuben, before we proceed, please will you briefly describe the critical care unit at Bara?
Sure. Bara is actually the fourth largest hospital in the world with approximately 3,000 inpatient beds. Just over 400 of those are dedicated non-neonatal pediatric beds. And against that large number of beds, the pediatric allocation of the mixed ICU is just 9. So we've got a general 9-bedded unit where we admit patients from 1 month of age until 16 years of age. As you can imagine, that puts us at quite an unfavorable ratio of inpatient beds to PICU beds. And that creates a lot of difficulties with triage. There's high pressure on beds. As a result, the acuity of patients that we admit is of quite high illness. And we are under a lot of pressure to ensure rapid turnover where we can, trying to ensure as short an ICU stay as possible.
Thank you for that, for setting the scene for us. By way of background into the topic today, let's briefly chat about where the bundle came from and the potential major benefits of its implementation.
Okay, so the ABCDE bundle, as it was initially known, was introduced by Wes Ely and colleagues in a 2010 commentary published in Critical Care. It sought to focus attention on the care of ventilated critically ill patients in the latter phase of the ICU stay, noting that improved management during this phase would further the aims of a faster liberation from mechanical ventilation, which would then in turn consequently reduce length of ICU stay and then length of hospital stay and limit some of the harm associated with the provision of intensive care. The group identified 5 interrelated areas of focus, namely pain management, liberation from mechanical ventilation, sedation management, attention towards prevention and management of delirium, as well as early mobilization of patients. Subsequently, a 6th element, that of family engagement and empowerment, has been included in the bundle, together with the understanding from practitioners that the bundle applies perhaps to virtually all ICU patients, whether ventilated or not, and at an earlier phase of the ICU stay, even if not all the elements are relevant throughout, many of them are. In terms of their benefits, I think that at that time frame, 2010, there was a growing recognition that many survivors of ICU were left with persistent and life-altering impairments encompassing several domains, physical, cognitive, and mental. These series of impairments have collectively become known as the post-intensive care syndrome, a term first coined by Dale Needham and his group in following a report published in Critical Care Medicine in 2012. It has been more recently described in the pediatric population by Joseph Manning and investigators in Pediatric Critical Care Medicine in 2018. And because of the difference between pediatric ICU and adult ICU, the pediatric group included a 4th domain, that of social health, to include considerations relating to the impact of critical care on the family, both directly and as a result of the impairments of the child itself. The benefits from the beginning were better symptom management, improved pain and sedation management. It actually probably led to the concept of analgosedation, where the focus is now on analgesia first and sedation secondly, prevention of delirium, and bigger outcomes such as reduction in length of stay, reduction on the time on mechanical ventilation, reduction in complications such as infections, ICU-acquired weakness, delirium I've already mentioned, as well as improved longer-term outcomes, a reduction in mortality, reduction in incidence of post-intensive care syndrome, and also a reduction in symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Thanks. You brought up that there may be some differences between adults and pediatrics in this space. A recent narrative review by Engel and colleagues proposed some modifications to the A2F bundle, given the specific needs of critically ill children. With respect to the B element, the authors proposed a change in emphasis to breathing and mechanical ventilation, as opposed to the more traditional both spontaneous awakening trial and spontaneous breathing trial. What are your thoughts on this proposal, and how does this tie in with current practice within your unit?
Well, it was a very interesting proposal by Julian Engel et al. And published in Frontier Pediatrics in 2022. They proposed a modified ABCDF bundle for children. And I think that that's a really good idea, given that there are some differences between children. And I think that the authors also pointed out that although there's less trial evidence in the pediatric space compared to adults, a randomized controlled trial published in Intensive Care Medicine in 2016 did find somewhat unexpectedly a higher mortality in the group where daily sedation interruption together with protocolized sedation was employed versus protocolized sedation alone. While that wasn't thought to be a causal relationship, the fact that that occurred gave pause for the complete implementation of the bundle as devised for adults in the pediatric population. In terms of the B element specifically and the practice within our unit, I think that we follow what was reported in a recent survey of 161 PICUs, which found that the performance of spontaneous awakening trials was uncommon. I think they found that only 14% of the units surveyed reported spontaneous awakening trials. Within our unit, we recently revised our approach to screening for extubation readiness testing. And I think we incorporated some of the elements of a spontaneous awakening trial into that. We look at trying to identify patients who are close to the point where you start thinking about potential extubation. We are not a 24-hour ICU. We're much better staffed during the day. Our working day starts close to 8 a.m., so we tend to omit sedative doses close to 4 a.m. In the hope that around the 8 a.m. time frame, the patients will have awakened sufficiently for us to consider extubation readiness testing. We have slightly different expectations depending on the type of patient. In patients with neurological injury, we tend to focus on whether the GCS supports airway protection, whereas patients who come in with respiratory failure, for example, we like to have sustained eye opening before we would consider the patient suitable for extubation readiness testing. So I'd say that we don't really practice a formal spontaneous awakening trial, but rather we do a form of screening before we embark on extubation readiness testing.
Okay, so please walk us through your approach to spontaneous breathing trials, or as you've mentioned, extubation readiness testing, as is perhaps more relevant in current practice.
So we've recently revised our guidance regarding liberation from mechanical ventilation in light of the recent clinical practice guidelines published by the Palisi group in PCCM January of 2023. So in line with that document, We've opted for a protocolized screening to determine eligibility for exacerbation readiness testing, which I've mentioned briefly. We look to see whether the initial indication for invasive mechanical ventilation has improved. And if that's present, then we look at whether the patient is suitably awake following a lightening of sedation. We look to see whether the patient has any evidence of significant fluid overload. In that case, we will probably delay and refocus our efforts towards diuresis. I also pay attention to what the serum calcium magnesium phosphate is, as well as the potassium. All of these are predictors of muscle weakness. And if all of these are in place, then we will proceed on to extubation readiness testing. The first step, of course, is the spontaneous breathing trial. We think this is, of course, fundamental. And we advise that should there be failure of the spontaneous breathing trial, we don't proceed on to any of the further steps of the ERT. In terms of spontaneous breathing trial, our preferred method is a pressure support trial. We usually use a PEEP level of 5 centimeters of water together with a pressure support level of 5 centimeters of water. More recently, as we become aware of the conversations within the pediatric literature, we've begun to explore the use of CPAP in patients at higher risk in an attempt to perhaps reduce excessive assistance during an SVT, which might then mask a patient's inability to potentially be liberated. Routine duration, 30 minutes as per guideline, and then up to 120 in patients who you think are at higher risk of failure. Assuming that the SPT has been passed, we then move on to the other steps. In terms of who actually does it, we've got a significant complement of medical officers, junior staff, and they would often be the ones at the bedside for the duration of the SPT. An important message we're trying to get across is that an SPT, once there's evidence of failure, needs to be concluded immediately, and that there's no benefit in continuing in the hope that the patient improves. We also, as a unit, do once daily SPTs. So any patient that fails an SPT will next get an SPT no earlier than 24 hours later. We then move on to an airway assessment, and then assessment of respiratory muscle strength. And then lastly, just a final evaluation of hemodynamic status. If all of that's in place, we give consideration to the use of dexamethasone if there's a risk of upper airway obstruction. We do use post-extubation advanced respiratory support, mostly by means of a high-flow nasal cannula. We don't employ a lot of non-invasive ventilation at Barra. And then the patient is then extubated shortly thereafter.
Great. Thank you for that. Can you share with the audience some of the challenges you experience in your setting with regards to the implementation of these aspects of the bundle?
I think one of the biggest challenges is that our unit, and I suspect South Africa as a whole, for the most part, is currently having a problem in terms of the availability of highly trained critical care nurses. We're struggling to replace an aging nursing population. It's unclear to us what the reasons for this is, but it certainly is being felt on the ground. And as a result, it's difficult to implement some of the strategies associated with the liberation bundle as a whole, because protocolized analgesia and protocolized sedation strategies are heavily dependent on regular scoring by your critical care nurse, and then titration of your therapies in response. In our local environment, to try and mitigate some of this difficulty, a lot of that responsibility then falls on our junior medical staff. Quite often, they're the ones that implement the scoring in terms of a pain scale or a sedation scale. And they would be the ones then in consultation with the consultants to then decide what is the appropriate management plan in response to the scores. Another problem is that outside of the ICU, there's very little knowledge around the value of improving the management during the weaning phase. And so it's an ongoing challenge to educate our new staff as to the benefits of good management in the tail end of the maintenance phase of mechanical ventilation and moving into the weaning phase.
Kuben, thank you very much for sharing some of your insights and experiences with us. And we certainly hope that the audience has enjoyed listening. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Rob. It's been a pleasure to do this podcast, and I hope that the audience finds this informative.